Välkomna hit allesammans. Peter Eriksson heter jag, jobbar som förläggare på förlaget Libris, eller Libris förlag. Och är glad att hälsa er välkomna hit till den här seminariet, releasen, lite grann möjligt, på en alldeles utkommen bok som har kommit ut. Och ni ska höra mer om den idag. Om drygt 3 veckor så är det 9 april. Och då är det precis 70 år sedan Dietrich Bonhoeffer avrättades i fängelset. Bara några fåtal veckor innan Adolf Hitler tog sitt liv och andra världskriget gick till ett slut. Och vi har alla, tror jag, på många sätt en relation till Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Han är en sån där gigant som många av oss kommer från olika håll och från olika delar utav kyrklighet och utav samhälle och har blivit både inspirerade och utmanade och blivit fascinerade utav ett sådant rikt livsöde på de korta år som han fick. Idag så ska vi få möta författaren till den här boken. Erik Metaxa som är här hos oss i Stockholm för några dagar. Varmt välkomna hit and a very warm welcome to you, Erik. You have started to see parts of Sweden, especially Stockholm so far. You have been fascinated by buildings and by the language and by Ingmar Bergman. But you're not here to talk about that. You're here to talk about your book and about Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And you start off now. So let's give a warm welcome to Erik and to Sweden and to the
Well, it is a joy to be here. I knew I would like Sweden, and I do. It's beautiful. I don't know, usually people aren't able to appreciate what they have because it's what you know, but it's a very beautiful place you have here. Even if it weren't sunny, I think it would be beautiful. But I'm just in a good mood just looking at the buildings, and you have a great sense of style. I think you already knew that since you lived here. And I don't include IKEA in this group. I have to be honest with you. Some things, but no, not really. I have so much I want to share. We don't have too much time. So first of all, let me share the only Swedish words I know. Tack så mycket. Did I get that right?
Yes.
I know 2 more. Tack så mycket. That's 4. Okay, good. So I want to tell you how I came to write Bonhoeffer, and then I want to tell you a little bit about the story of Bonhoeffer, and we'll have some time for questions, and Eskil will share some different thoughts. But basically, how I came to write Bonhoeffer. My story is that my mother grew up in Germany, near Leipzig. My father grew up in Greece. They both left war-torn Europe and ended up in New York City, where they met in an English class in 1956. And they were, of course, married, and I was born. And if you were raised in a family that is Greek and German, this means you will be raised Greek. I don't know why, but this is a law. This is somehow. And so I grew up in the Greek Orthodox Church. The Greek Orthodox Church, for most people in the United States, like many ethnic churches, it's a cultural experience. And sometimes it can be a very positive cultural experience, but the problem is it can sometimes be only a cultural experience. And for me, it was mainly a cultural experience. This is where the Greeks hang out with the other Greeks in the church. But I didn't get much of, you know, what we call the gospel. I think sometimes that, you know, the Greek Orthodox Church is the Greek Orthodox Church. You know, it's mostly the club where the Greeks get together. And for me, this was, as I say, was a good experience. It was not a bad experience, but that's the extent of the experience, is this being Greek, kind of. And so by the time I went to college, I went to Yale University, which is a very secular environment.
You okay? Sorry.
I apologize for being short. I'm not Swedish. I don't know what to... Thank you. That's okay. I play with things when they're in front of me. It's fine. I'll stop touching. So basically, I really realized once I was at Yale that I didn't know what I believed. And I say that the elite institutions of the United States, like much of the West, like much of Europe, you're a little bit ahead of us, are pretty secular. And so for the first time I realized that I'm not sure what it is that I believe, and I began to try to figure out what's the meaning of life. I was concerned with what is the meaning of life, or whether there is such a thing as the meaning of life, and I was thinking about this. I was an English major. I wanted to be a writer. At places like Yale, they don't admit that they don't have answers to these questions. They pretend the questions do not exist. Who would ask what is the meaning of life except, you know, a simple person? Sophisticated people know that life has no meaning, and we're in love with the idea that it has no meaning. There's something very sexy about meaninglessness, you know. I'm kidding, really. So so it's an interesting thing. You mentioned Bergman. Bergman wrestles with dignity and courage with this idea of God, and does the universe have meaning, or is it meaningless, and what does this mean? He wrestles with these things, and because he wrestles with them honestly, we say he's bleak. Or is it just because he's Swedish? I don't know. I think because he's honest. But in the United States, we didn't wrestle with these questions. We just pretend they don't exist, get a great job, and you'll be distracted by your career for a few decades, and then it's all over. So you don't have to worry about it too much. I did not get a good job. I wanted to be a writer, so I floundered around. I don't know if anybody here is a writer, but, you know, I did not get a good job to distract me. I had plenty of time to think about the meaning of life, or the idea of the meaninglessness of life. And for me, it was not a happy time, because I really was struggling with this. I mean, I wasn't obsessed by it. I wasn't, I didn't have the intellectual purity to be thinking about nothing else. I was distracted enough, but I wasn't distracted enough to avoid the question. And so if you're trying to be a writer and you're not doing a great job, and you know, you end up floundering around. So I floundered around. I moved to Boston. I kind of drifted for a while. I was never a bold sinner in the Lutheran idea of being a bold sinner. I was just a decent person trying to get by, trying to figure things out, and getting nowhere. But I was in a hurry. What did they say it? I'm lost, but I'm making good time. No, that's a joke. But and so I basically ended up. If you flounder around and drift in your 20s, you inevitably end up moving back in with your parents. This is a law in the United States of America. And so I floundered around, I moved back in with my parents. Now, I think I mentioned to you my parents are European immigrants. If your parents are European immigrants and you live in the United States, it's not a good idea to move back in with your parents, because they don't have the generous... Most Americans would say, oh, Eric's finding himself, he wants to be a poet, or who knows, or whatever. My parents said, Eric, you should find yourself a job. Get out, you know. And so this was a very hard time for me. And in the midst of this misery, I took a job doing the only thing I knew to make a living was proofreading. I don't know if that term means anything, but I wasn't proofreading wonderful texts, novels. I was proofreading chemical manuals for a horrible conglomerate called Union Carbide. It was extremely depressing. If you know any Hebrew, the word is Gehenna. That's the description. Thank you. So I was very unhappy. And in the midst of this misery, I met a man who was quite serious about his faith, and he began sharing his faith with me. And I was trained at Yale to avoid these crazy people. You know, Christians, they're insane, and they may blow you up or something, so just avoid them. But I was in enough pain to keep talking to him. And he was, of course, one of the most generous, wonderful people I've ever met in my life. But I was, so in some ways I was interested in some of the things he was sharing, but I was also repulsed culturally because I'd been trained at Yale to avoid, you know, evangelical Christians. And we kept talking for some months, but I was never really buying what he was selling. But then about a year later, I had a dream, and I won't tell this now because of the time, but in the dream, all I can tell you is God spoke to me in a very dramatic way. I actually tell the story, if you're interested in it, and since you speak English, you can go to ericmetaxas.com. There's a video where I tell the story. But it's an amazing story. It's a dream. I cannot account for it. I was unconscious, in case I didn't make that clear. I'm unconscious every night when I sleep. And I had this dream, but it was really vivid. I don't dream much. And this was clearly not a product of my brain. In my mind, there's no doubt that it was God spoke to me in a way that just completely blew my mind. And I woke up and my life was changed and I accepted Jesus. But before that, if somebody had said to me they accept Jesus, I would have cringed uncomfortably. And I said, I don't like people like that. So suddenly, I was one of those people I didn't like, and now I had to deal with it. And I've been dealing with it ever since. And so, basically, everything changed. And in the middle of this period, this guy who had been sharing his faith with me gave me a copy of Bonhoeffer's Cost of Discipleship and said, have you ever heard of Bonhoeffer? And I said, no. Who's Bonhoeffer? And he said, well, Bonhoeffer's a German pastor who, because of his Christian faith, spoke up for the Jews and was killed by the Nazis in the Flossenbürg concentration camp. And I said, are you kidding? I've never heard this story in my life. And I was a little bit scandalized. And to this day, I'm still scandalized when I hear stories that I should have heard of but never heard. I said, this isn't right. How can I live in a world and go and get this supposedly wonderful education and I never even heard of this story? And so I was intrigued by Bonhoeffer. I mentioned that my mother grew up in Germany. My grandfather was killed in the war. He was not pro-Hitler. He did not like Hitler, but he wasn't asked whether he wanted to go fight in the war or not. So I saw Bonhoeffer as somebody speaking up for people like my grandfather, Germans who were not on board with what was happening, but who had no choice, who had two little girls, had to go to war and was killed. You start realizing how complicated it is. And as a German, I started struggling with this question. How did this happen? What kind of a people would allow this to happen? And so Bonhoeffer sucked me into this idea. So at that point, this was 1988, I turned my career over to God, which is a great idea because I had not been doing such a great job with the career. I don't know if you noticed, if you're taking notes. But I ended up writing many children's books. I wrote some humor. I worked for VeggieTales. Do they have VeggieTales in Sweden? No? Do you have vegetables in Sweden? And I ended up writing a book on apologetics with the title Everything You Always Want to Know About God But We're Afraid to Ask. And I was being interviewed on this book on CNN. And the woman on CNN, I expected really hostile questions, like how can a good God allow suffering? Or, you know, the kind of questions that you're worried you're going to be asked. And instead she said, in your book you mentioned William Wilberforce. Tell me about Wilberforce. And I said, I mentioned Wilberforce in my book? Really? And I remembered, oh yeah, there's a paragraph. I mentioned William Wilberforce is a man who had a strong conversion experience and because of his faith in Jesus spoke up for the African slaves and absolutely... Now my daughter is just sticking her nose in the door. In other words, you and Mom can come back in an hour. Is that okay? You don't have to listen to the speech anymore. All these people feel your pain. Classic. Like, I'm not going to notice. So, I really meant that. All these people, you're free to go. You want to hear my Bonhoeffer speech again? I would just go shopping and come back in an hour. I'm not kidding. You're dismissed. We'll see you in an hour. These people would love to meet you in an hour. Okay. See ya. So they're being really good by being willing to hear this for the 100th time, but I can't bear it. Literally the 100th time. So but they shouldn't have shown up late, should they have? No, it serves them right. They're embarrassed. So anyway, I basically was, I guess, the in the middle of the interview when this person asked me about Wilberforce, I just mentioned a few words about Wilberforce as a man who changed the world because of his Christian faith. He stood up for the Africans. And I remember, a few days later, a publisher contacted me and said, how would you like to write a biography of William Wilberforce? And I said, I've never wanted to write a biography in my life. I've always been far too self-centered to want to spend a couple of years thinking about some other person. And so I wasn't interested, but... To be asked, I was so flattered to be asked whether I wanted to write a biography because this movie was coming out, Amazing Grace, about Wilberforce. And I said, let me think about it, and I prayed about it. And this is one of those very rare cases in my life where God spoke to me, not in an audible voice, but I don't say that kind of thing lightly. And so I said, okay, I'm going to write this book. So I wrote the book, and everywhere I'd go speaking about Wilberforce, people would say, who are you going to write about next, assuming I had now found my you know, lifelong job, career, genre, métier. I was going to now write biographies, and I said, I don't really want to write another biography, so I'm not interested. But if you hear something often enough, you begin wondering and thinking, and I thought, if there's one person about whom I might be tempted to write, it would be Bonhoeffer, the only person besides Wilberforce that I feel that way about. And so, of course, I did end up writing about Bonhoeffer, and I had no idea that what I was getting into, I think. I think I had the most basic idea. I said, this is a man who, because of his faith in Jesus, spoke up for the Jews and was killed by the Nazis. He's a hero, and I want to write about him. But I didn't know very much. And I think sometimes it's good to be ignorant because you can have a fresh view of things. So I waded into it. I wrote the book. I didn't dream that the book would do well. It was very difficult to write the book. I have a new book out in English called Miracles. And in that book, I tell the story of writing the Bonhoeffer book. And there's some specifics which I won't go into, but it really was very painful for me. And then the publisher wanted to cut the book in half and all this kind of stuff. And I wasn't willing to do that. And I had to switch publishers. So it was a very painful thing. But basically, I had a keen sense that God's hand was on this book, it wasn't an accident that I decided to write it. And in writing it, I simply did the best I could to tell the story. And I never dreamt that it would be published in many different languages. I think this may be the 18th translation, by the way. That's amazing to me. I'm not used to this kind of treatment of my work. I'm really thrilled. And I think it's because the Bonhoeffer story resonates with people. There's something about the story. Because of the story, I was able to meet two United States presidents, Eisenhower and LBJ. Just kidding. That's a joke. I know you. They're dead. I got to meet President Obama and George W. Bush. And I know George W. Bush read the book. Obama received the book. I don't know if he read it or not. But anyway, it's one of these stories that, as I got into it, I started realizing it has resonance today, that there's a power to the story. Now, I didn't write it because of that. I just wanted to tell the story of this great hero, because I think we need heroes who are real heroes. And I think we forget sometimes that, you know, we've lived in a time where the heroic has been denigrated, I think, generally since the 60s, that, you know, there's a worm in every apple. And I think that we forget that there are people who have basically lived these heroic lives, and we need to know that, and we need to be encouraged. And so, but there's something about Bonhoeffer, which, again, I didn't realize until pretty much I had finished writing the book, the power of the story. So I'll give you just the outline of the story now, but so you have an idea of who we're talking about in case you don't already. But Bonhoeffer was born in 1906 into what has to be described as an extraordinary family. His family, you know, some big people they come out of nowhere. I mean, nobody really knows who are the parents of, I don't know, Christopher Columbus or Van Gogh or Michelangelo. You don't think of it. You just think that they're these geniuses or these amazing people with ambition. But Bonhoeffer comes out of a family that is extraordinary. His father was the most famous psychiatrist in Germany for the first half of the 20th century. Super doctor, scientist, an amazing figure in Germany. In fact, I write all of this in the book, but he was, well, I won't go into details, but he was a big deal in Germany, his father. And the whole family, there were geniuses. His brother was a genius. He split the atom with Max Planck and Albert Einstein. I've actually seen the atom in a museum in Dresden. It's, just kidding, that's not true. But he's, can you imagine, I mean, this is the level. He went into physics and he split the atom with Max Planck and Albert Einstein. The other brother went into law. He became the head of the legal department of Lufthansa. I mean, these are geniuses, but everyone in the family was a genius. The mother, the father, all the kids, the ancestors are, and again, that's in the book, but the ancestors were big deals. They were famous people, famous theologians and painters, just an extraordinary family. So he grows up in this family at age 13. To show you how precocious he is, he decides he wants to be a theologian. Now, when your father is a top scientist and your oldest brother is a top scientist, this was not the most popular thing. But just to show you that the kind of intellectual honesty and courage, that at 13 he decides I want to be a theologian, you know. This is not a typical choice. If you know any 13-year-olds who want to be theologians, make them see, you know, a good doctor, because you really, you got to straighten them out. But he knew it. He wanted to be a theologian. He goes to Berlin University, which, of course, is the greatest place in the world at this time to study theology. He studies under von Harnack and all these greats. And he's recognized as a theological genius. He goes to New York in 1930. After, by the way, he gets his doctorate at age 21. I hope you're impressed. And he goes to New York. I think it's to kill time, because he basically is a... he's not able to... Well, I'm sorry. In becoming a theologian, the question he is asking and answering on this very high academic level is, what is the church? This is a big question on the level of Bonhoeffer's mind, to think, what is the church? He travels to Rome when he's 17, actually, and he gets a picture of the church, which is not a typical picture you get in Germany in the 1920s, right? He begins to see the church as universal. The church is something that goes beyond national borders. That's a big deal in Germany 10 years in the future, right? This becomes a big deal. He begins to understand that the church is the church, and he was open-minded and ecumenical enough to recognize the Catholic Church as part of the church. He didn't just say, no, that's a cult, and the Lutherans are right. I mean, he really was very open-minded, not so open-minded that he didn't believe anything. But he was writing on this high level about what is the church, and then he decides he wants to be ordained as a pastor, not just to be an academic theologian on this very high level, but also to be ordained as a pastor, to take these grand ideas of theology down to the level of the people in the pew, to teach children, you know. And this is one of the things that I have to say that I love about Bonhoeffer, is that he was able to translate big ideas. You know, if you can't translate the big ideas for regular people, maybe you don't understand the big ideas. And we've all met people who they talk on this high level and you realize they're speaking to themselves. They hardly know what they're talking about. And that's, you know, academics can be like that. If I've offended any academics here, it's definitely intentional, I want to tell you. So basically, Bonhoeffer decides that I want to be this high-level theologian, but I also want to be a pastor. But he can't get ordained until he's 25. So he goes to New York when he's 24 years old to study at Union Theological Seminary. And he was not expecting to be impressed by what he found at Union. It was several levels down from Berlin University, and he was quite disappointed, actually, in what he did discover there. He felt the theology was very shallow. They just knew that the fundamentalists are wrong, you know. We've all met people like that. They just know the other guy is an idiot. That's their theology. And so basically Bonhoeffer goes there. But what he experiences in New York, which was very powerful for him, is he goes to the African-American church in Harlem, and he sees a group of people who are not strangers to suffering, for whom church is not just religion, it is their whole life. And they are involved in every kind of social action. They realize that their faith is not just intellectual, it's not just theological, it has to be lived out. And you have to live your faith. If you're not living your faith, you really don't have faith. Who are you kidding? It's not just an intellectual exercise. Bonhoeffer got that, and he saw that in the African American church. They were interested, for example, in the lynchings that are going on down south, and they were talking about these things. So he makes this connection, and he sees that in America and in Germany, he wasn't seeing this kind of thing, except in what he called the Negro churches. It's the only place he saw this. And so he comes back to Berlin in 1931, and his friends can see he's different. His faith has come alive in a way. Now, he was not a heretic or an agnostic before, but his faith somehow deepened. And Germany had also changed dramatically. The Nazis were the ninth largest political party in the Reichstag before Bonhoeffer left. When he comes back, they are the second most popular party in the Reichstag, and they're on their way up. And he can smell that Germany is turning toward National Socialism. Now, most of us in this room flatter ourselves to think, oh, we know what we would have thought at the time. We would be just like Bonhoeffer. We would know that this is wrong. Well, that's ridiculous. Most people had no idea about National Socialism because the Nazis were not advertising that they're in bed with Satan. You know, that's not a good thing to advertise, by the way. If you're in bed with Satan, keep it quiet. So the Nazis were not exactly saying everything. They were saying what they needed to say. They're very pro-church, pro-morality. You know, they're against atheism and Bolshevism and so on and so forth. And so most people were not really understanding what was happening, but Bonhoeffer somehow, for a number of reasons, seemed to know that the Nazis are trouble. And he begins to try to wake up the German church, to get the church to see that they must recognize this and stand against it. And of course, we know, like all prophets, he was unsuccessful. Everybody has reasons, whether people, liberals have liberal reasons, conservatives have conservative reasons, and it was exactly the same in Bonhoeffer's day, that the church, all across the spectrum, had different reasons. The liberals in the ecumenical movement were, we don't want to upset the apple cart, and, we have to discuss this and give it time and whatever. And then the conservative, the pietists, were saying, well, we don't want to be political, we want to pray more, we don't want to get political and stuff. And so everybody had their excuses, and Bonhoeffer was very frustrated because he understood that the time is short, that if the church doesn't rise as one and stand against National Socialism, at some point the church will lose power to stand. And it's the image from Gulliver's Travels, some of you know the picture of Gulliver being tied down by the Lilliputians. I assume that you're familiar with the story of Gulliver. But anyway, the idea of the giant being tied down by the Lilliputians, that at any point he could stand up and crush them. But if he's asleep long enough, eventually they will be able to put enough ropes down that he won't be able to stand. And that, to me, is a picture of the church in Germany in this period. Is the church is asleep, Bonhoeffer is saying, if you don't wake up and stand soon, it will be game over. You won't be able to stand. And he was exactly right. They refused to really take the action. They kept, they take a little action. They do that. They formed they wrote the Barmen Declaration in 1934. They formed the Confessing Church. But by this point, they had already been marginalized. And even the Confessing Church was confused. These are the good guys. And they were even slightly confused. Many of them were still pro-Hitler. They didn't understand the depth of the evil. And again, you have to see yourself in this, because most of us wouldn't have seen it either. But Bonhoeffer saw it, and he kept trying. In 1934, he spent a little bit over a year in England as a pastor in a German-speaking congregation. He had really gotten fed up with the battle in the German church. I think he realized within a year, it's lost. We're not able to win. But of course, they didn't know how far the Nazis would get. But so he sort of retreats to London and is teaching there. But he's on the phone all the time. He's flying back and forth. I mean, he was all over the place, multitasking in 1934. And eventually, the Confessing Church, this is the church that broke away with some courage from the state church, right? Because the Nazis wanted a Reichskirche. They wanted a one strong German church, which, when I was talking before about the Greek church, it's the same concept, that a national church doesn't need to be a bad thing, but it very easily can become a bad thing. And Bonhoeffer saw that the Nazis were using the German church. We want a strong German church. Well, they wanted something that was strong in German and anti-Semitic and pro-Nazi and pro-Hitler, and they wanted to call it the church. But Bonhoeffer saw that their theology had nothing to do with Christian theology. It was paganism, it was social Darwinism, it was nihilism, it was everything that was antithetical to the values of the gospel. And so a number of these pastors tore away and became this thing called the Confessing Church, but even that was not, as I said, able to really stand against Hitler. So Bonhoeffer was frustrated. Now the Confessing Church, the good guys, decided at some point that they wanted to have seminaries to train young men to be real pastors. And so they said to Bonhoeffer, why don't you lead one of these seminaries? So he went up to Zingst on the Baltic coast, and then Finkenwalde up there in Pomerania, to lead young men in this goal of becoming pastors, a seminary, right? Where he would teach them not simply how to be ecclesiastical figures, church figures, but to really be disciples of Jesus Christ. And as you know, I hope, these aren't the same thing all the time, right? There are many people that they know how to go through the motions, they know how to run a church service or whatever it is, but Bonhoeffer said, no, we've come to a time where you must live your faith. And so he was really teaching them to be disciples of Jesus Christ in this place. This is full-time, this is what Bonhoeffer would eventually call religionless Christianity, right? That term has been misunderstood. But the idea is that we're not playing church. We're not just going to teach you how to function. We're going to teach you what it means to give your life to God, to Jesus, and to live your faith. And so this is what he did for a number of years. Of course, eventually the Gestapo shut that down. He then took it kind of underground. They shut that down. His ability to serve God was being narrowed and narrowed and narrowed. In 1938, of course, the war was coming. They could tell the war was coming. And Bonhoeffer knew that he wasn't going to be able to do much anymore. Once the war came, he would have to pick up a rifle and fight, and he wouldn't do that. Now, not because he was a pacifist. He's often described as a standard-issue pacifist. That's not really accurate. Bonhoeffer knew, however, that he could not fight in Hitler's war. This was a war of aggression, of revenge for World War I, and so on and so forth, Lebensraum, all these things that, you know, Hitler used as excuses. And Bonhoeffer knew that there was no way that he would fight in this war. But the question is, what do you do? There's no such thing as being a conscientious objector in 1939. So Bonhoeffer decides to go back to America to sort of escape the trouble. And the short version is that he goes back and people pull strings so that he's able to go away, to get to America. But no sooner does he arrive in New York again than he realizes he's made a mistake. He realizes as he's praying, and he was very diligent in praying. He didn't make these decisions lightly. But he really felt God was leading him to go back to Germany to stand with his people during this difficult time, which is courageous. I remember when I first heard that story, I said, wow, this is an amazing thing. This guy who's an enemy of the Nazis is going to go back after he's already escaped. It's chilling. But he was not a fearful person. And I think if your faith is strong, you don't have much fear because you realize, I fear God. And what that means is that I'm going to do what God asks me to do. And I know that anything else, that's really stupid. And so Bonhoeffer says, I'm going to do what I feel I'm led to do. And I'm going to go back. And he goes back. And long story short, he gets involved in the Abwehr, which is German military intelligence. Now, this is a little complicated. This is where the Spion part of the title, did I say that correctly? Spion, sort of. Spion. He becomes a spy, a double agent. Think about this. His brother-in-law was a member of the Abwehr, German military intelligence, and this was the center of the conspiracy against Adolf Hitler. It's a dramatic concept that within Germany, within military intelligence, there's a conspiracy against Hitler. I mean, they were not all stupid, and so his brother-in-law, Donani, was one of the leaders. And he recruits Bonhoeffer and says, look, you're a pastor. You have connections all over Europe. I will recruit you to become a member of German military intelligence. Everybody knows war has come. We've all got to do our part. You may not love Hitler, but we're all going to pitch in. That's what it's going to look like. But we know that I'm recruiting you now to be a double agent. You're going to be a double agent. You're going to look like a member of German military intelligence, functioning as a pastor, traveling around Europe. But you're going to be working for the conspiracy to kill Hitler. And what's the main thing that Bonhoeffer did in this role was he took a ferry to Sigtuna. Have you heard of Sigtuna? Yes. I've never been to Sigtuna, but I would like to go. He came to Sigtuna. Why? Because he was able to meet the Archbishop of Chichester. The English Archbishop was in a neutral spot. He came here and they were able to meet. And he was able to communicate with this Englishman. Think about this. You're meeting the enemy, all right, during a time of war. If he was caught doing this, he would be killed. He went to Sigtuna to secretly meet with Archbishop George Bell from England. Bell had connections with the Churchill government. And Bonhoeffer's role in Sigtuna is to communicate with him that there are a group of us in Germany who are fighting against Hitler, working against Hitler. Will you help us? Churchill, will you help us? If we succeed in killing Hitler and his top lieutenants, will you help us form a legitimate German government? And we all know that Hitler said, Nein, danke. That's German for no thank you. It's really, it's a scary, I said Hitler, I meant Churchill, I killed the joke. Churchill says no thank you. Now this is a chilling thing, that they're asking for help at the risk of their lives, and Churchill says, we're not interested, it's too late, every German in our book is a Nazi, we will not do business with you, goodbye. So suddenly Bonhoeffer realizes, I am not, I failed. There's nothing we can do. So he goes back, and the rest of the story is, you know, a little bit depressing if you think about it. I mean, they tried to kill Hitler on a number of occasions. Now, again, Churchill has given them no promises, but they still go ahead. Think about this. Even though they know that they have no assurances from the English, they say, we're going to do the right thing. We're going to kill the head of our government because we know he is evil, and we believe history will judge us right. We know in the short term we'll be judged as traitors to our own nation. So they try to kill him. We know that they don't succeed. The last time is in the Valkyrie plot. They fail. When that happened, not only did they fail to kill Hitler, but for the first time in all these attempts, the conspiracy is exposed. And so thousands are arrested. Bonhoeffer was already, he had already been arrested for something else, for money laundering, having to do with his involvement in trying to get some Jews out of Germany to save their lives. So he was originally arrested and put in jail for that, not for any involvement in the plot to kill Hitler. Nobody knew about this. But as the Valkyrie plot unfolded and people realized what's going on, people are tortured, names come up, Bonhoeffer's name is near the top of the list. So suddenly we know his days are numbered. To make the long story a little shorter, he's eventually transferred to the Gestapo prison in Berlin. He was not tortured, but he was threatened with torture. And then in the last days of the war, April 9th, Peter said it, April 9th, 1945, this is only 3 weeks before Hitler takes his life in the bunker. It's right before the end of the war. But they discover this diary from Admiral Canaris, and it's really clear who these figures were. So Hitler, being the petty man that he was, says, I want all of these men killed. He had been intending to use them as bargaining chips. Bonhoeffer was a number of prisoners who were high-level prisoners, and I think Goebbels and Goering and Himmler, they all knew that we're losing the war, we're going to need some bargaining chips to save our lives. So they had a number of high-level prisoners. Bonhoeffer was one of them. But at the end, Hitler says he must die. So April 9th, he was executed at Flossenbürg concentration camp. And typically, this is a sad, tragic ending, but there's more to it. When I first heard it, I thought of it as merely sad. But Bonhoeffer, I want to underscore as I finish, is that he really was a profound Christian. He really believed what he said he believed, or what we say we believe. He really believed it. You get that, not just from his writings, but from his life. And in 1933, 12 years before he died, he gave a sermon about death, and I quoted at the end of my book. He talks about death as, he says, death is the most terrible thing imaginable apart from faith in the God of the Scriptures. But if you have faith in the God of the Scriptures, death is not frightening. He says, if you've ever glimpsed the realm of the resurrected, the kingdom of heaven, you know from that moment that you're homesick, that this is your true home. And he says, this needs to be the reality, not just some vain hope, but to know that this is true. And he was preaching this to his congregation. You can imagine that, looking at him like, you know, this hot-headed young pastor really believes this stuff. You know, he obviously hasn't lived. But he really did believe it. And when he goes to the gallows in 1945, for a number of reasons, you from what he wrote, you know, just before that, you get the idea that his faith was very, very strong, and that he did not go to his death wringing his hands, but he knew that he had been obedient to God and that he was going to be with God. And he knew this, not just this is some hope, but you get the impression that Bonhoeffer was one of those people who knew this. He wrote a poem not too many months before he died where he refers to death as the last station on the road to freedom. And I just think that we need to know that people have gone before us in the faith who really believed, and Bonhoeffer to me is heroic in that sense, because we wouldn't be talking about him today if he had tried to wriggle out of the situation. There's just something about him that recommends itself to us, and I have been very inspired by it. And the greatest thing to me to hear about this book is that people who've read it have said that his life has affected their life. You know, they say, my book changed their life. I know it's not my book. I just wrote about Bonhoeffer. He lived this life, and these kinds of lives affect us. And so I think that when you encounter a life like that, no matter what you believe, you know, it will affect you. And so I feel, you know, privileged somehow that I've been involved in getting Bonhoeffer's story out there more and more, because I just think we need to be encouraged. At least I do, anyway. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.